A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one about exercise-induced asthma, or more precisely, exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. He's lived it himself. You're in good shape, you run regularly, but 10 minutes into hard effort, your chest tightens up and suddenly you're gasping. Not because you're deconditioned, because your airways are literally clamping down in response to the act of breathing hard. And his real question is, what is it about exertion specifically that triggers this? Why does the very thing that's supposed to make you healthier cause your lungs to rebel? Meanwhile, newer guidelines position it as a first-line controller for exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. So the safety versus efficacy question isn't settled, and it directly affects how active people manage their own lungs.
But now we've got daily controller options like Montelukast, Singulair, that take a completely different approach. Except the FDA dropped a boxed warning in March 2020 about serious neuropsychiatric side effects. Suicidal thoughts, agitation, depression. So the choice isn't as simple as it used to be. The old approach was basically, relax the smooth muscle with a beta agonist and call it a day. The new approach says, wait, there's an inflammatory cascade being triggered by the exercise itself, and if you don't address that upstream, you're just playing whack-a-mole with symptoms.
So let's get into what's actually happening in the airways when exercise sets this off, because the mechanism is weirder and more specific than most people realize. And the fact that Daniel can be in good cardiovascular condition and still experience this tells you something important. The trigger isn't about fitness level. It's about what happens to the airway lining when you move huge volumes of air through it.
Exactly the right framing. So let's define what we're actually talking about, because the terminology matters here. Exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, or EIB, is a transient narrowing of the airways that's triggered specifically by exertion. Up to 90% of people with asthma experience EIB. But here's the number that throws everyone. 10 to 20% of elite athletes without diagnosed asthma also have it. Cross-country skiers, swimmers, long-distance runners. Some of the fittest humans on the planet, and their airways still constrict during hard effort. And it's disproportionately common in elite athletes, especially winter sport athletes. Cross-country skiers, speed skaters, ice hockey players, some studies put the prevalence above 50% in those groups.
It's not just an asthma problem. It's an airway stress problem that happens to overlap heavily with asthma.
An elite cross-country skier breathing cold, dry air at 150 liters per minute. That's the kind of ventilatory demand that sets this off, regardless of how conditioned they are. You finish your run, you're cooling down, and then your chest gets tight. That post-exertion timing is a big differentiator. There are two main theories, and they're probably both operating at the same time. The dominant one is the osmotic theory. When you exercise hard, you're moving huge volumes of air. Your airways have to humidify and warm all of that air before it hits your lungs. That process evaporates water from the airway surface liquid, the thin layer of fluid that lines your bronchial epithelium.
Which probably explains a lot of the "I thought I was just winded" stories. You stop running, you feel okay for a minute, and then it hits. That doesn't feel like asthma to most people. It feels like you're recovering weirdly.
The old paradigm for managing it was straightforward. Pre-treat with a short-acting beta agonist, a SABA, like albuterol, 15 to 20 minutes before you exercise. Two puffs, go run, you're fine. And for a lot of people, that worked acutely. That's exactly what's happening. And airway epithelial cells don't like that at all. They interpret that osmotic stress as a threat. Within minutes, mast cells in the airway wall degranulate and dump out inflammatory mediators, histamine, prostaglandins, and critically, cysteinolecithin.
Leukotrienes are the heavy hitters here. To understand why the treatment changed, we need to get into what's actually happening in the airway during a hard workout, and it's not what most people think.
They're released within minutes of that osmotic stimulus, which is why symptoms come on so fast. You're 5 or 10 minutes into a hard run, and suddenly your chest is tight and you're wheezing. The idea is that during heavy exercise, you're breathing large volumes of air that's usually cooler and drier than your body temperature. That rapid ventilation cools the airways. That's the core cascade. Now the second theory, the thermal theory, adds another layer. During heavy breathing, especially in cold air, the airways cool down significantly. When you stop exercising, they rewarm rapidly.
The airway gets cold, then it warms up too fast, and the plumbing overreacts.
So, you've got smooth muscle constriction from the leukotrienes plus swelling from the vascular rebound. And if you have them breathe warm, humid air during exercise, EIB is dramatically reduced. That doesn't fit neatly with a pure thermal model. Which brings us to the osmotic theory, and this is where the evidence has really converged.
This is the one that explains why being in shape doesn't protect you.
That's the rewarming and vascular congestion kicking in on top of the initial mediator release. But during heavy exercise, your minute ventilation can jump from maybe 5 to 10 liters per minute at rest to 100, even 200 liters per minute. Your nose simply cannot keep up. The lower airways are forced to take over the humidification job, and they're not designed for it. As that huge volume of dry air passes over the airway surface liquid, water evaporates from the lining. In fact, elite endurance athletes might be at higher risk precisely because they spend so much time at high ventilation rates. Their airway epithelium is getting repeatedly dehydrated day after day, training session after training session.
You're basically desiccating the inside of your airways.
That's exactly the right image. The airway surface liquid becomes more concentrated, more salty. Once the osmolarity rises above about 350 milliosmoles, something critical happens. It's one of those cruel biological ironies. The cross-country skiers have some of the highest EIB rates in all of sports. They're breathing minus 20 degree air at enormous minute volumes for hours. That's the perfect storm for airway surface dehydration.
Let me throw a scenario at you. Someone does a 2-hour slow jog on a mild day. Someone else does a 10-minute all-out sprint in cold, dry air. Which one is more likely to trigger EIB?
Even though the jog is 12 times longer. Because the sprint pushes minute ventilation much higher, and if the air is cold and dry, the evaporative water loss from the airway surface is dramatically greater. It's not about duration, it's about the rate of water loss from that thin layer of fluid lining the airways. They cause sustained, powerful, smooth muscle contraction, they increase mucus secretion, and they promote edema in the airway wall. It's a triple threat.
The exercise itself, the sheer volume of air moving through the pipes, creates an osmotic stress that triggers a cellular alarm system. And the alarm system releases chemicals that are orders of magnitude more powerful than what most people think of when they hear inflammatory response.
This is why the SABA-only approach was incomplete. A short-acting beta agonist like albuterol works by binding to beta-2 receptors on airway smooth muscle and telling those muscles to relax. It's a direct bronchodilator. It will open the airway, and it does it fast. But it does nothing to stop the mast cells from degranulating. It does nothing to block the leukotrienes from binding to their receptors. Albuterol, a short-acting beta agonist, taken 15 to 20 minutes before exercise. It works by directly relaxing airway smooth muscle. It'll open you up for about 3 to 4 hours. And for a long time, that was the entire playbook.
It has limitations. In fact, if you're an endurance athlete with a high training volume, you might be exposing your airways to more osmotic stress, not less, because your minute ventilation during training sessions is higher and you're doing it more frequently.
Second, that 3 to 4 hour window means if you're training twice a day or doing a long event, you might need multiple doses. Third, and this is important, frequent use can lead to tolerance. The beta receptors on the airway smooth muscle downregulate, so the same dose becomes less effective over time. Some researchers think EIB in elite athletes without underlying asthma represents a form of airway injury from repetitive osmotic stress, not classic allergic asthma. It's a different endotype with potentially different long-term implications.
The "you're just out of shape" misdiagnosis is doubly wrong. First, because EIB happens to people at peak fitness. Second, because high-level training might actually increase your risk.
The misdiagnosis persists for a reason. Mild EIB can be subtle. The drop in FEV1, that's forced expiratory volume in 1 second, might only be 10 to 15%. Montelukast takes a completely different approach. Instead of forcing the smooth muscle to relax after the leukotrienes have already been released, it blocks the cystino-leukotriene receptor, size LT1, so the leukotrienes can't bind and can't trigger constriction in the first place.
Let's talk about that classic study you mentioned, Anderson and Deviscus in 2000. They showed that inhaling hypertonic saline could mimic EIB in susceptible individuals. Albuterol is like unclenching a fist after it's already closed. Montelukast is like preventing the signal that tells the fist to close.
Because it's a daily oral medication, not an inhaled rescue drug, you get 24-hour coverage. Studies show it reduces EIB severity by 50 to 80% in most patients. You take it once a day, and you're protected regardless of when you exercise. And it gave researchers a tool to study EIB in the lab without needing a treadmill and a metabolic cart.
The threshold concept is worth underlining. Anderson's group identified that once airway surface liquid osmolarity crosses roughly 350 milliosmoles, mast cells start firing. Below that threshold, they're stable. Above it, they degranulate. That's a binary switch, not a gradual slope. It explains why EIB can be so variable. On a humid day, you might stay below the threshold. On a cold, dry day, you cross it quickly.
The warning was based on post-marketing reports, not clinical trial data, which means these events were rare enough that they didn't show up in the original trials, but emerged once millions of people were taking the drug. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but one theory is that the initial bout of exercise partially depletes the mast cell mediators, so there's less to release on the second bout. You can't screen for it, you can't predict it, you just have to know that it's a possibility and monitor for it. And that's particularly concerning for adolescents and young adults who seem to be more vulnerable to the neuropsychiatric effects.
For someone with frequent disruptive EIB, say a competitive athlete training daily, the benefit of preventing attacks might well outweigh that rare risk. But for someone with mild occasional symptoms, a pre-exercise albuterol might be the safer choice.
This is where shared decision-making with your doctor becomes critical. It's not a one-size-fits-all answer. You have to weigh the frequency and severity of your EIB against the small but real risk of neuropsychiatric side effects. And if you do start Montelukast, you need to watch carefully for any mood changes, sleep disturbances, or behavioral shifts, especially in the first few weeks. Multiple randomized controlled trials have shown that Montelukast reduces the maximal fall in FEV1 after exercise by 40 to 60%, and it also shortens recovery time. But the key is recognizing them early. Insomnia, irritability, unusual dreams, feeling agitated or flat, these can creep up subtly. If you're not looking for them, you might not connect them to the medication.
There's also a non-pharmacologic piece here that doesn't get enough attention. Warm-up preconditioning. A once-daily pill that just works in the background is a different proposition.
For the next 1 to 2 hours, your airways are less responsive to the same exercise stimulus. You've partially depleted the mast cell mediators, and it takes time for them to reaccumulate. In March 2020, the FDA required a boxed warning for Montelukast. It's like a mini-exposure therapy for your bronchial epithelium, and it works surprisingly well. Combine that with breathing through a scarf or mask in cold weather, or choosing sports with lower ventilation demands. Swimming in warm, humid air versus running in cold, dry air, and you can reduce your EIB burden without any medication at all. And it specifically states that Montelukast should not be first line for allergic rhinitis, but it can still be used for asthma and EIB when the benefit justifies the risk.
That's a heavy warning to drop on a medication that had been widely prescribed, including to children, for years.
And as a retired pediatrician, I can tell you this changed the conversation in clinics overnight. Speaking of things that get looks, and now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. Some clinicians stopped prescribing it entirely. Others took a more nuanced approach, which is what the guidelines support: assess the individual patient's risk, have a frank discussion, document the conversation, and monitor closely.
Right. The open question I keep coming back to is this. We're blocking leukotriene receptors and relaxing smooth muscle, but we're not doing anything to prevent the osmotic trigger itself.
The mechanism isn't fully understood. Montelukast does cross the blood-brain barrier, and leukotriene receptors are expressed in the brain. That's where the field is heading. There's work on agents that modify the composition of the airway surface liquid, increasing its water-holding capacity. And on the technology side, wearable devices that track minute ventilation and airway resistance in real time could let athletes predict when they're approaching the threshold for an EIB episode, and back off or modify their breathing before symptoms start.
Which would be a genuine shift from reacting to attacks to preventing the conditions that cause them. But for now, the practical takeaway is, know your triggers, understand the mechanism, and make an informed choice about whether the daily pill with the boxed warning is worth it for your specific situation. You tell the patient about the warning, you start at a low dose, and you instruct them to stop immediately and call you if they notice mood changes, sleep disturbances, or anything that feels off.
That's exactly the framework, and it's worth comparing the numbers directly. SABA pretreatment reduces the maximal FEV1 drop after exercise by about 50% on average. Montelukast reduces it by about 50 to 60%. If you've got a question like Daniel's, something you've experienced firsthand and want to understand at the mechanism level, send it in. We'll dig into it. The thing is, most people don't even realize there's a distinction to make. They get diagnosed with asthma, they wheeze when they run, they assume it's all one thing. But EIB has its own diagnostic code, its own pathophysiology, its own treatment logic.
What actually defines it? If I'm a doctor and someone comes in saying they get tight-chested every time they play soccer, what separates that from just poorly controlled, persistent asthma? 28-year-old recreational runner, EIB confirmed by EUCAPNIC Voluntary Hyperapnea Challenge. That's the gold standard diagnostic test where you breathe dry air at high flow rates to simulate exercise conditions. She was using albuterol before runs, but still getting breakthrough symptoms during interval training when her ventilation was highest. Switched to Montelukast 10 mg at night. Symptoms resolved within 3 days. It's the specificity of the trigger. Exercise turns it on, and when the exercise stops, it eventually turns back off. The drug worked beautifully for her lung. But the CNS side effect, even mild, was enough to tip the scales.
The controller med is handling the baseline inflammation, but it's not blocking that acute osmotic leukotriene cascade we just described. The boxed warning gets attention because of the severe outcomes, but the more common scenario is probably subtler, and that's why the stop and call me instruction is so important. Patients need to know what to watch for.
There are also emerging alternatives worth mentioning, even though they're not first line for most people. Inhaled corticosteroids remain the foundation for persistent asthma with EIB, but they take weeks to reach full effect. Not ideal if your main problem is exercise-triggered symptoms and you don't have daily asthma otherwise. The treatment approach has to be different. You're not trying to get someone's overall asthma under better control. You're trying to prevent a specific cascade that fires off within minutes of high ventilation. And the newer biologics, omalizumab, mepolizumab, they show promise for severe EIB, but they're reserved for patients with eosinophilic phenotypes, and they're expensive.
Different tool for a different job. Let's stay with that osmotic mechanism for a minute, because the numbers involved are staggering. At rest, you're moving maybe 6 to 8 liters of air per minute.
Given all of that, the mechanism, the treatment shift, the safety trade-offs, what should someone actually do if they recognize themselves in Daniel's prompt? Let's make it practical. Conditioning, meaning warming it to body temperature and saturating it with water vapor. Don't accept you're just out of shape as an answer. EUCAPNIC voluntary hyperapnea, or a standard exercise challenge with spirometry, is the way to confirm EIB. It's objective, it's reproducible, and it rules out other things, like vocal cord dysfunction or deconditioning.
Multiply that by 150 liters per minute for a 10-minute hard effort, and you've pulled a significant volume of water out of that thin layer of fluid coating your bronchial epithelium. The risk is real but rare, and for many people, the benefit of reliable, round-the-clock EIB control outweighs it. The key is informed consent. You should know what you're signing up for and what to watch for.
Third, don't sleep on the non-pharmacologic strategies. A proper warm-up, 10 to 15 minutes of low-intensity exercise before you go hard, can induce that refractory period where EIB is blunted for up to 2 hours. Wearing a face mask or a scarf in cold weather helps by trapping heat and moisture, reducing the osmotic load on your lower airways. The epithelial cells interpret that change as damage.
The epithelial cells shrink as water is drawn out of them by the rising osmolarity of the surface fluid. That shrinkage activates signaling pathways. Specifically, it triggers an influx of calcium ions into the cell. That calcium spike is the alarm bell. It signals the mast cells sitting right beneath the epithelium that something is wrong.
Mast cells being the sentinels of the immune system, loaded with granules full of inflammatory mediators. The osmotic theory explains the acute trigger beautifully, but why do some people develop EIB without having persistent asthma at all? Is that a distinct endotype with different long-term implications? Leukotrienes are wildly potent. You mentioned 1,000 times more potent than histamine at constricting bronchial smooth muscle. If that's right, it would imply different treatment targets and maybe different long-term management strategies.
They bind to the CCLT1 receptor on airway smooth muscle cells and essentially tell that muscle to clamp down and stay clamped. That's why EIB doesn't just feel like a little tightness. It can be frightening, like breathing through a straw. Inhaled leukotriene receptor antagonists are in development. The idea being, you could get the benefits of montelukast delivered directly to the airway, reducing systemic exposure and potentially reducing the neuropsychiatric risk. It's a remarkably fast cascade. Now, the thermal theory adds a second wave. During heavy breathing in cold air, the bronchial blood vessels constrict to conserve heat. When exercise stops, those vessels rapidly dilate, rewarming hyperemia.
Daniel's prompt lands at an interesting moment. The old advice, two puffs and go, worked for a lot of people, but it was incomplete. The new advice is more effective, but comes with a real safety conversation. Which is why some people get a biphasic response. The immediate constriction during exercise, a brief recovery, and then a second wave of symptoms 15 or 20 minutes after they stop. It's about what happens when you push 100 liters of dry air per minute through tubes that evolved for a fraction of that.
Not everyone gets both, but when they do, it's miserable.
In 1910, a British expedition passing through the Gilbert Islands, now Kiribati, witnessed an intense red aurora so unusual that the ship's naturalist initially logged it as a distant volcanic eruption. The red color came from high-altitude oxygen emitting at 630 nanometers, a wavelength that only appears during particularly energetic solar events.
A volcanic eruption in the sky. That's one way to misread the physics.
What exactly is exercise? Induced bronchoconstriction, and how is it different from the asthma you might have had as a kid? The distinction matters because it changes how you think about treatment. There's evidence that repeated osmotic stress actually remodels the airway epithelium. The cells become more permeable, more reactive to subsequent challenges. The mast cell population in the airway wall may increase.
Someone with persistent asthma might wheeze at rest, wake up at night with symptoms, react to allergens. EIB is more specific. The trigger is the exercise itself, and between episodes, the airways can be completely normal.
The prevalence numbers tell an interesting story. Up to 90% of people with asthma also have EIB. But here's what catches people off guard. About 10 to 15% of people without any asthma diagnosis at all still get EIB. And they manage it. But it underscores the point. EIB is not a fitness problem, it's a physics problem. You're moving air too fast for your airways to condition it, and the resulting osmotic shock triggers a local inflammatory storm. Understanding that mechanism is what makes the treatment choices make sense.
Which is why the you're just out of shape thing is such a persistent misdiagnosis. If elite athletes get it, fitness isn't the variable.
The classic presentation is one of those clinical clues that's easy to miss if nobody's told you about it. Symptoms typically peak 5 to 15 minutes after you stop exercising, not during the activity itself. But it's a downstream fix. The leukotrienes are still being released, the mast cells are still firing. You're just forcing the smooth muscle to ignore those signals for a few hours. And that window is only 3 to 4 hours. Fine for a single workout, less useful if you're training twice a day or doing a long event.
Plus, the tolerance issue. If you're using it frequently, those beta receptors downregulate, and the same dose does less.
Which is why frequent SAVA use, more than 2 or 3 times a week, is considered a marker of poor overall asthma control. You're papering over a process instead of interrupting it. The problem was, it masked what was actually driving the process. You'd get smooth muscle relaxation, the airway would open up, but the underlying inflammatory mechanism kept firing every time you exercised. Montelukast blocks the cystinyl leukotriene receptor, size LT1. those LTC4, LTD4, LTE4 molecules we talked about, the ones that are 1,000 times more potent than histamine, they can't bind. The signal never reaches the smooth muscle. You take it once daily, orally, and you get 24-hour coverage. Studies show it reduces EIB severity by 50 to 80% in most patients. There are two competing theories of what causes EIB, and this debate shaped decades of research before the evidence really converged.
Lay them out. Every die.
The first is the thermal or rewarming theory. During heavy exercise, you're breathing large volumes of air that's usually cooler and drier than body temperature. That rapid ventilation cools the airways. March 2020. The FDA required a boxed warning, their highest level safety alert, for montelukast. Serious neuropsychiatric events. Suicidal thoughts and behavior, agitation, aggression, depression, sleep disturbances, nightmares.
This wasn't from the clinical trials.
It emerged from post-marketing surveillance. Once millions of people were taking the drug, these rare but serious reports started accumulating. They hadn't shown up in the original trial data because the incidence is low enough that you need a huge population to see the signal.
There's no way to predict who's going to have a problem.
That's the hardest part. No clear risk factors. No screening test. It can happen in someone with no psychiatric history, no family history, nothing. The incidence is low, but it's unpredictable, and when it happens, it's serious. At rest, your nose handles air conditioning. It warms and humidifies every breath before it reaches the lower airways. That's where the risk-benefit calculus gets personal. If you're a competitive athlete training daily, EIB is disrupting your life constantly. The 50 to 80% reduction in symptoms might be worth accepting a very small risk. But if you're someone who runs recreationally twice a week and has mild symptoms, a pre-exercise albuterol might be the safer play. The osmolarity of that surface liquid starts climbing.
You're desiccating the inside of your airways.
These can creep up subtly, and if you're not looking for them, you might not connect them to the pill. Mast cells sitting in the airway mucosa sense that osmotic shift and they degranulate. They dump their contents, histamine, prostaglandins, and crucially, cystinoleukotrienes. These are lipid mediators, and they are among the most potent bronchoconstrictors in human physiology. And the good news is, when you stop the drug, those effects are generally reversible. She switched back to as-needed albuterol, added a proper warm-up protocol, and both her EIB and her mood stabilized. They cause sustained, powerful, smooth muscle contraction, they ramp up mucus secretion, and they promote edema in the airway wall. It's a triple threat.
15 minutes at about 60% of max effort, and you induce a refractory period. For the next hour or two, your airways are less reactive to the same exercise stimulus, and that alarm releases chemicals, orders of magnitude more powerful than what most people picture when they hear inflammatory response.
Combine that with a scarf or mask in cold weather to pre-warm and humidify the air you're breathing, or choose sports with friendlier air conditions, swimming in a warm, humid pool versus running in cold, dry air, and you can reduce your EIB burden substantially without touching a prescription. But it does nothing to stop the mast cells from degranulating. It does nothing to block leukotrienes from binding to their receptors. It's like turning down the volume on the speakers without unplugging the amplifier. The behavioral strategies have exactly zero risk of neuropsychiatric side effects, though I will concede that a scarf over your face in August does invite commentary.
Fashion is a small price for functional airways. Let's land on some concrete things you can actually do with all this. First, get a real diagnosis. Too many people assume they're just out of shape when their chest tightens up during a run.
There's a paradoxical relationship here. Elite endurance athletes, cyclists, runners, cross-country skiers, have incredibly high minute ventilation during training, sometimes for hours at a time. That distinction matters, because the treatment for EIB is different from the treatment for deconditioning or for poorly controlled persistent asthma. If you're wheezing because your inhaled corticosteroid dose is too low, adding montelukast isn't the fix. Adjusting your controller is. The diagnosis shapes everything downstream.
Second, if you do go on montelukast, monitor yourself. And I mean actively monitor. The neuropsychiatric effects can be subtle at first. A shift in sleep quality, a new irritability, feeling flat or disconnected. You might not notice it yourself.
The misdiagnosis persists because mild EIB can be subtle. The drop in FEV1, forced expiratory volume, in 1 second might only be 10 to 15%, especially for adolescents and young adults. That age group seems more vulnerable, and they're also less likely to attribute mood changes to a pill they're taking for their lungs. Parents and coaches should be looped in.
The Anderson and DeVisca study in 2000 was the one that really tipped the scales. Third, the warm-up protocol. 15 minutes at about 60% of your max, enough to get you breathing hard but not gasping. That induces a refractory period where your airways are less reactive for the next hour or two.
The hypertonic saline challenge recreates the osmotic conditions of exercise, induced hyperpnea without any confounding variables. It's not instead of medication necessarily, it's alongside whatever you and your doctor decide. But a lot of athletes find that a good warm-up protocol lets them use less albuterol or get by without daily Montelukast. It's one of those low-tech interventions that doesn't get enough airtime because there's no drug rep selling it.
Fourth, and this one is straightforward. If you're reaching for your albuterol before exercise more than 2 or 3 times a week, that's a signal. Your asthma control probably isn't where it should be. Talk to your doctor about whether you need a daily controller rather than just pre-treating every workout.
Frequent SABA use isn't just a marker of poor control. It can actually make things worse over time as those beta receptors downregulate. You end up needing more to get the same effect. It's a cycle you want to break, not reinforce. One theory is that the initial bout partially depletes mast cell mediators, so there's less to release on the second bout. Another is that it triggers protective prostaglandins that stabilize the mast cells. Either way, it's a real phenomenon with clinical utility.
What if you could stabilize the airway surface liquid itself? Make it more resistant to evaporative drying during high ventilation? If leukotrienes are the main bad actor here, the obvious next question is what happens when you block them?
If you could prevent the osmotic trigger from firing in the first place, you wouldn't need to block leukotrienes or relax smooth muscle. The whole cascade never starts. Unlike a SABA, which reverses the squeezing after it's already happening, Montelukast prevents the leukotrienes from ever delivering the squeeze signal. It's upstream in a way that albuterol simply isn't.
Instead of turning down the speakers, you're unplugging the amplifier before the signal even gets there.
Imagine a sensor that alerts you when you're approaching the ventilation rate and humidity conditions that trigger your EIB, so you can back off or modify your breathing pattern before the osmotic threshold is crossed. It also has a 24-hour duration of action. One dose at night covers you for a run at 6A, a swim at noon, and a pickup basketball game in the evening. No timing puffs, no carrying an inhaler.
That's a real quality of life difference. If you exercise at unpredictable times, or you're the kind of person who decides to go for a run on a whim, the 15 to 20 minute pre-treatment window for albuterol is annoying. A pill you take before bed and forget about is a different proposition entirely.
Adherence data reflects that. People are more likely to consistently take a daily pill than to reliably pre-treat with an inhaler before every workout. But this is where the story takes a sharp turn. In March 2020, the FDA required a boxed warning for Montelukast, the strongest warning they issue short of a recall. Post-marketing surveillance had linked it to neuropsychiatric events, agitation, aggression, depression, insomnia, suicidal thoughts, and in rare cases, completed suicide. The people who catch the neuropsychiatric side effects early are the ones who were told to watch for them. Tell someone you trust that you're starting the medication. It's a small step that makes a real difference.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to hear more, find us at myweirdprompts.com.
If you've got a question like Daniel's, something you've lived and want to understand at the mechanism level, send it in. We'll dig into it. Montelukast had been popular in pediatrics precisely because it's an oral medication. No inhaler technique to teach, no spacer to clean, just a chewable tablet once a day. After the boxed warning, a lot of parents were understandably alarmed. Some clinicians stopped prescribing it entirely. Others took a more measured approach, which is what the guidelines support: assess the individual patient, have the frank discussion, document it, and monitor closely.
The absolute risk of serious neuropsychiatric events appears low. Best estimates put it under 1%. But the signal is real, and it's not just background noise. There are case reports of symptoms resolving within days of stopping the drug and recurring when it's restarted. That's a pretty clean causal signal, even if the mechanism isn't fully understood.
The mechanism is unclear. Montelukast does cross the blood-brain barrier, and leukotriene receptors are expressed in the brain. There's some evidence that blocking them might affect neurotransmitter regulation or neuroinflammation pathways, but we don't have a crisp mechanistic explanation. That makes the risk-benefit calculus harder. You can't predict who's going to have a problem.
The clinical dilemma shapes up like this. For someone with mild intermittent EIB, they get symptoms once every couple of weeks, maybe. A pre-exercise SABA is probably still the right call. The boxed warning risk, even if it's small, isn't worth it for occasional symptoms. But for someone with frequent EIB, twice a week or more, or someone who just won't consistently time their inhaler before exercise, Montelukast offers superior control. The key is shared decision-making. You tell the patient about the warning, you start at a low dose, and you give them clear instructions. If you notice mood changes, sleep disturbances, or anything that feels off, stop the drug and call me.
That's the framework, and let's compare the numbers directly. SABA pretreatment reduces the maximal FEV1 drop after exercise by about 50% on average. Montelukast reduces it by about 50 to 60%. The magnitude of protection isn't dramatically different in absolute terms. The real advantages of Montelukast are the 24-hour coverage, the once-daily dosing, and the fact that it addresses the inflammatory cascade rather than just overriding smooth muscle contraction. For the right patient, those advantages tip the scales.
Let's make this concrete with a case, because the trade-off gets clearer when you see it play out. 28-year-old recreational runner, EIB, confirmed by eucapnic voluntary hyperpnea challenge. That's the gold standard diagnostic test, breathing dry air at high flow rates to simulate exercise conditions. She was using albuterol before runs, but still getting breakthrough symptoms during interval training, when her ventilation was highest. Switched to Montelukast 10 milligrams at night. Symptoms resolved within 3 days. 6 months later, she noticed mild mood swings. Nothing severe, but enough that she mentioned it. Discontinued the Montelukast, mood normalized, EIB symptoms returned. That's the efficacy versus safety trade-off in one patient. The drug worked beautifully for her lungs, but the CNS side effect, even mild, was enough to tip the scales back.
That case highlights something important. The side effects don't have to be catastrophic to matter. Mild mood changes that affect your relationships or your work are a valid reason to stop. The boxed warning gets attention because of the severe outcomes, but the more common scenario is probably subtler, which is why the stop and call me instruction is so critical. Patients need to know what to watch for.
There are other options in the toolbox worth mentioning, even if they're not first line for most people. Inhaled corticosteroids remain the foundation for persistent asthma with EIB, but they take weeks to reach full effect. Not ideal if your main problem is exercise-triggered symptoms and you don't have daily asthma otherwise. Mast cell stabilizers like Cromolyn sodium can work, but they require dosing 4 times a day, which is a lot to ask of someone who just wants to go for a run. And the newer biologics, omalizumab, mepolizumab, show promise for severe EIB, but they're reserved for patients with eosinophilic phenotypes, and they're expensive.
The practical reality for most active people with EIB is that the choice comes down to SABA pre-treatment versus daily Montelukast, with the boxed warning as the deciding factor in the conversation. And that conversation should happen with a doctor who knows the evidence and can walk through it honestly. Not someone who either dismisses the warning entirely or refuses to prescribe Montelukast under any circumstances. Both of those extremes leave patients worse off.
Given all of that, the mechanism, the treatment shift, the safety trade-offs, what should someone actually do if they recognize themselves in Daniel's prompt? Let's make it practical. First, if you're experiencing chest tightness, coughing, or unusual shortness of breath 5 to 15 minutes after exercise, especially if you feel fine during the activity, get formally tested. Don't accept "you're just out of shape" as an answer. Eucapnic voluntary hypermia, or a standard exercise challenge with spirometry, is the way to confirm EIB. It's objective. It's reproducible, and it rules out other things, like vocal cord dysfunction or deconditioning.
Second, if you're using a SABA before every workout, ask your doctor whether a daily leukotriene receptor antagonist like Montelukast might be more appropriate. have the conversation about the boxed warning. The risk is real but rare, and for many people, the benefit of reliable, round-the-clock EIB control outweighs it. The key is informed consent. You should know what you're signing up for and what to watch for.
Third, don't sleep on the non-pharmacologic strategies. A proper warm-up, 10 to 15 minutes of low-intensity exercise before you go hard, can induce that refractory period where EIB is blunted for up to 2 hours. Wearing a face mask or a scarf in cold weather helps by trapping heat and moisture, reducing the osmotic load on your lower airways. And during low to moderate intensity work, nasal breathing reduces the volume of unconditioned air hitting the lower airways. None of these replace medication when it's needed, but they're zero-risk adjuncts that actually work.
That warm-up effect is one of those things that's been known in exercise physiology for decades, but still doesn't make it into most clinical conversations. The refractory period is real. If you do a gentle jog before your intervals, your second bout of exercise will produce less bronchoconstriction than the first. It's not a cure, but it's a tool.
We've covered the mechanism, the treatment shift, and what you can actually do about it, but there's one question that's still open, and it's where the research is heading. The osmotic theory explains the acute trigger beautifully. Dry air, evaporative water loss, mast cell degranulation, leukotrienes, bronchoconstriction. But it doesn't explain why some people develop EIB without having persistent asthma at all. Is that a distinct endotype with different long-term implications?
That's the question that's driving a lot of the current work. Some researchers think EIB in elite athletes, especially those without underlying allergic asthma, represents a form of airway injury from repetitive osmotic stress. It's not classic type 2 inflammation with eosinophils and IgE. It's more like an overuse injury of the airway epithelium. If that's right, it would imply different treatment targets and maybe different long-term management strategies than what we'd use for allergic asthma with EIB.
Which matters, because if you're treating an overuse injury with anti-inflammatory drugs designed for allergic disease, you might be aiming at the wrong target.
And there are some interesting things in the pipeline that might change the landscape. Inhaled leukotriene receptor antagonists are in development. The idea being you could deliver Montelukast directly to the airway, get the same receptor blockade where you need it, but with much lower systemic exposure. If the neuropsychiatric effects are driven by the drug crossing the blood-brain barrier, an inhaled formulation could potentially sidestep that risk entirely.
That would be a meaningful advance. The efficacy without the boxed warning conversation hanging over every prescription.
Bronchial thermoplasty is also being studied for severe EIB, though it's still experimental for that indication. The procedure uses radio frequency energy to reduce airway smooth muscle mass. It's already approved for severe persistent asthma. The logic for EIB would be that less smooth muscle means less capacity for bronchoconstriction, regardless of what's triggering it. But it's invasive, it's expensive, and the evidence base for EIB specifically is thin.
For now, the practical landscape is what we laid out. SABA pretreatment versus daily Montelukast, informed by an honest conversation about the boxed warning, with non-pharmacologic strategies as a zero-risk complement either way. But the fact that the science is still evolving on the endotype question means the treatment paradigm might look different in 5 or 10 years.
That's the kind of thing that makes this topic worth revisiting as the evidence accumulates. Daniel's prompt landed at a moment where the old advice, two puffs and go, has been quietly replaced by something more nuanced, and the replacement is still being refined.
If you have a weird prompt about your own body, your medications, or something you've always wondered about health and science, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in you. your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.